He is a spy as well. He comes from Kansas. That's all we really know, he said. He appeared on the verge of speaking again when Michael thrust his hand out and greeted Tygo as though he were a courtier. John knew this was Michael's way. He would have done it for Allison's hairdresser or the court clown. A visionary! I would have him come with me to the Pardoness now, Marvel snapped. I've waited long enough. She's waited long enough. The time has come for him to prove something to one of us. I'll wait no longer. Tygo turned to John. Was it desperation in his eyes? John couldn't tell, but as quickly as John had seen it, Tygo nodded and bowed. I am at your service. What could it mean, Marvel's interest in Tygo? John had no time to wonder, however, before Allison took her father's arm. Do you think the Outlaw Carnival means us harm? She asked him quietly. This meeting, will it be dangerous? He seemed to recoil slightly at her touch and acted as though she hadn't spoken. She said, Father? Allison, I have no idea what they want. She stepped back. If she was stung by his tone, she did not show it. She took up her club again and walked alone to another hole. Did she often feel alone? John thought, perplexed. Then Michael rushed John into his office, and they had spread out their charts and water bowls. John was seated at the rough wooden table and locked for an hour within the heavenly math of so many overlapping orbits, and he drew triangles upon semicircles, and for the 100,000th time, he wondered if these shapes meant everything or nothing at all. And if people all did indeed live their lives as prescribed inside of them, or if the shapes were merely patterns thrust upon them arbitrarily. The king smoked as he waited, exhaling blue lungfuls of air that choked John until silently he opened a window. Outside on the green lawn, Allison had begun her golf course over again, this time with another maiden for a partner, and they shrieked with laughter as a warm, gentle rain began, and John felt something inside him tighten and release, until he realized it was only his breath, entirely mundane and predictable. But suddenly, he understood it had been the opposite all along. Each breath he took meant something, in spite of his every effort to render it meaningless. Chapter 19. The Thunder. Perfect Mind. Mr. Capellatio came back to the tent. It was nearly afternoon, and the girl could hear sparse droplets beginning to strike the tent. He took the box of her belongings down again and handed her her own brooch, the one Argento had given her that had come from their mother, and pressed it into her hand. She said, "What is this for?" The brooch in her hand like a black spider. "Black amber, sugar plum," he said, and picked up his hat from one of the sofas. "You wear it when somebody dies. Come on." He dusted off the hat and popped it back into a more perfect shape, then went into the damp light of the day, holding his arm above his head as though this could shield him from the droplets. She heard him laughing with another man just outside the tent. "Come on, I said," he called. She put on the only clothes she could find, the white tunic she had been wearing before the wedding. She pinned the brooch to her chest and went outside. Whoever Mr. Capellatio had been speaking to had gone. Her new husband took her hand and opened a parasol above both their heads. For the first time since they'd camped, there was almost no one around. She was not cold. Her soft leather shoes wet through as they walked. The black amber rock hung too heavily to the thin fabric of the dress front. She feared it might rip. Her thigh hurt where she'd burned it. They walked out past the boundaries of the carnival, past the sentinel fires, and a field where some draft animals were pastured, then through a hedge of pricking bushes. They saw a group of men when they mounted a tufted hill and came plodding around a thicket of low wet cactuses. The men stood in a slight natural basin. She'd never seen any of them before. They were huddled together around something she couldn't see. All of them were damp from the sprinkling rain. Mr. Capellatio led her closer. The tallest was old, a dark-skinned barrel. He wore a brilliant yellow tunic and seemed like the sort of man she might have trusted if she hadn't met him here. Now. She did not trust him, but he smiled sympathetically at her anyway, as though he knew her from somewhere, and she had the same thought. But then she wondered if it just happened that way sometimes, if there are people in the world who are instantly familiar to you. The other men parted to reveal what they had been crowded around. The girl froze. It was Mr. Capellatio's executioner's block, that black, shining death creation, and standing there beside it, with her hair chopped to her chin and very dirty but calm as a lakeshore, was Orchid. Her heavy blonde brows smudged all out of order. She still wore the dress from the wedding, which had been a brilliant deep blue, though now it was dingy and stained all down the front with what the girl could only assume was blood. The girl felt hypnotized, rooted in place. It was a feeling similar to when she'd first seen Mr. Capellatio on the battlefield, a knowledge that she should run compounded by her absolute lack of ability to do it. No one had held a parasol for Orchid. The rain had cut a rivulet down her face.
"Are you going to kill her?" she whispered.
"I don't like to talk about killing or dying in this special place," Mr. Capellatio said. He handed her the parasol, then swept his hand out over the whole of the landscape, which in this spot was ringed on all sides by scrub and palm bushes. To the left, she could hear the endless murmur of the sea. "My star," he said to her, "my sapphire. This place is the most holy in the world. This is where we left the earth, where we cut the binds of the sphere and blazed upward centuries ago. This, my wife, is where we first went to heaven. It happened. It is here that you will ascend your queenship. It's only right. This is the spot that I first took on the mantle of king, where I dispatched our prophetess Lois from the line of Hulda, using her own ritual to set in motion all that has happened thus far." He pointed to the sky, although the lights were invisible through the rain. He had killed Lois, Orchid's mother? Or had Lois allowed herself to become a sacrifice? The idea of Mr. Capellatio executing his own wife's mother was horrid to the girl, no matter his justification. She took a step away from him. The four other men walked to four points surrounding the black block. Surrounding her. Mr. Capellatio went to the center, where there was also a shallow stone basin, presumably to collect blood.
"Are you going to kill Orchid?" she whispered.
His face was awash of pacific resolve. At his feet, in the wet grass, his own blade, the pearlescent curved edge that he had used to behead her brother. She saw it now. His voice contained no doubt and no fear. "There is no death, Aurora. There is only wonder blood." The four men who stood with Mr. Capellatio all held their own swords, like ceremonial staves in front of them. The rain had gathered and was now a cool mist, collecting as droplets of water on blades and clothing alike. She began to shiver. Two of the men were in middle age, and one was older and one was younger. The younger man was shorter and stouter than the rest, and wore an otter skin over his cloak. He had a close-trimmed yellow beard.
"But who are these men?"
She tried to meet eyes with Orchid, who would not look at her.
"These are my orbiters, the leaders of our four other carnivals. The same four carnivals which you've seen gathered here at the Cape in anticipation of my coronation as king. Five is the holiest number. As a group of five acting as one, we cannot be vanquished. Each of these men has been convinced of the righteousness of our cause for many and many a year, and each has sworn an oath to die for me. They will be my cabinet when I ascend my kingship inside the palace compound. They have each forsworn their birth names, and taken up Nom de Guerre's in honor of the shuttles. Columbia, Challenger, Endeavor, Discovery. And I am Atlantis.
We have waited a long time for you, Sigil. You are the beacon that will bring forth the Age of Times. Glorify, one of them said.
Orchid was staring intently at Mr. Capellatio. Her arms were bound. The blonde man held her by the elbow. Now Mr. Capellatio came to the girl and took the parasol from her and tried to push his sword into her hands. She kept her fists balled up. He had executed her brother on this block. He must carry it around with him wherever he went. She looked at the stone as though she could burn it to death with her eyes. Did some small amount of Argento's blood remain in the rock? The day he died, she had been afraid. She hadn't watched. The guilt had closed her eyes. Now, she was different. It seemed every hardship of her life had carried her here as if by design. Her abandonment by her mother, her abuse in Argento's carnival, her kidnapping and enthronement, her marriage. All these past moments aligned perfectly, one atop the next, and she saw through them like a telescope. The thing she saw at the other end was her power. The girl had survived each and every trial, and they had led her here. The blonde man brought Orchid forward. He pushed her to the block, where he bent her neck down and to the side. The girl did not know if her mother was right, and all magic was lunacy, or if magic was surely everywhere, waiting to be known at the precise moment one was able to know it, and never an instant before. But she knew she felt power coursing through her, and it made her brave. She had power to do this, or refuse. She thought maybe she was magical. Mr. Capellatio said, "I'll hold your arm. It takes more force than you'd expect." He raised his eyebrows to the other men, who all chuckled darkly. The girl pulled at her white dress, which was sticking to her body in the light rain, and gathered herself to her full height. "I don't need any help." He peered at her closely, and spoke after a long moment. "Do you know what we're asking you to do?" "Yes." The girl could not stop looking at Orchid. The bloody dress, the eyelashes wet from the drizzle. Now that she stood so close to her, Orchid seemed very pale, and smaller than the girl had imagined, her body rigid and defiant still. The muscles in Orchid's arms flexed with tension. What would it take, she thought, for them to live together in harmony?
She took the sword from Mr. Capellatio.
Orchid's face remained still.
The girl spoke to them all, meeting in turn the eyes of the four orbiters and trying very hard not to sound afraid. She was not. It was as though she had never been afraid in her life.
"I am the Sigil. You were waiting for me. I'm here now. The great work is finished, and the world is different now," she began slowly. "I'll show you."
She raised the sword, but it was not Orchid's head she cut off. Instead, she pushed Orchid back to her knees, grabbed her bound hands, and cut the rope with a fluid swish. For a moment, Orchid's face went entirely blank. She could not have imagined this, but as soon as the girl had cut the rope, she brought the sword back down, the force of the metal driving through the bone grotesque and crunching. She did not pull back when the blade connected, even as Orchid let out a scream of fear, pain, confusion, like any ordinary woman who was afraid. The girl had severed one of her hands. All the men yelled together in a panic. Orchid continued screaming, blood pouring forth into the basin, and she flopped to the ground where more blood soaked the earth as she rolled around clutching the stump. Her hand lay dead on the block. Mr. Capellatio was by Orchid's side at once. He picked her up, pulling half her body from the wet earth and roared at the girl.
"My God! What have you done? You've ruined the spell! Everything we worked for!"
She spoke coldly. "I've given you a new spell."
"What?"
he yelled. Orchid's blood soaked the front of his clothes.
She still wailed. He looked as though he wanted to throw Orchid down and strangle the girl, and also like he wished he could pull his first wife to his chest to stop her pain.
"I told you last night," the girl said, "but you didn't listen. The eon of pain has ended. The shuttles are back. Hers is the last blood to be spilled, but not for magic's sake. This, a punishment. She tried to kill me."
They fell silent. Orchid opened her eyes. A weak laugh came from her.
"A law of mercy," she gasped.
"What?" he demanded.
"She gives you a new law of mercy."
Mr. Capellatio stroked Orchid's face. He pulled off his cloak and wrapped it tightly around her bleeding arm.
"What are you talking about, my radiance?" "The texts say new ages shall be rung in like thunder by a perfect mind. Remember? Here is your thunder, your perfect mind. Listen as she gives you a new law, David."
He paled.
"What creature better than a woman to stay our hands at the executioner's block?" he whispered. "To stop our swords at the very moment when bloodshed becomes a sin again."
But Orchid had stopped listening. She was gazing out over the soggy field in the direction of the compound. Then she fainted. Mr. Capellatio gathered her into his arms and held her body to his with such familiarity that all at once the girl felt like a stranger watching them make love. She stepped back, her heart thudding. Just then, he looked up at her with blazing eyes.
"It is always a woman whom the heavens come to. It was a woman who gave us the doctrine of wonder blood."
"Killing is wrong," the girl said. He stared at her from the ground, then stood up, holding Orchid as though she weighed nothing.
"Let me tell you, there is no right or wrong in magic. Magic is. Magic exists apart from your belief."
"I believe in magic," she said coldly, "but killing is still wrong." Mr. Capellatio conferred with his orbiters. The seconds stretched on, and the girl felt them draw out like the long blade of his knife.
"Might Orchid die from her wound?"
She was strong. The girl doubted she would die. With their backs to her, the girl could see only the chin-length, jagged remains of Orchid's light hair. One of her arms, the one with a hand, hung slack along Mr. Capellatio's leg. After a time, the orbiters were nodding together, agreeing with each other. They had accepted her law of mercy. Mr. Capellatio had saved face and won them back. They all returned to the carnival then. The men went away, where she had no idea. Mr. Capellatio carried Orchid. He gave the girl the severed hand to carry. A pale, heavy lump. It was like a living being still. She could almost feel Orchid's fingers moving among her own. In the tent, he took it away from her and placed it in a canvas sack. He summoned the crones to care for Orchid. He bent to his first wife's face, smoothed her mussed eyebrows, and kissed her as deeply as if she were awake. Then he strode past the girl without looking at her. She had the feeling that by doing what she had known to be right, she had done her husband a gruesome wrong. The subjectivity of truth, for the first time, kindling within her a confusion she could not ignore.
"Oh, Lucidity," she thought, "leave me."
Chapter 20. The Watchtower of the Universe. Marvel Parsons watched the King and John Sousa leave the golf course to make their silly horoscope. He stood there a long moment beside Tygo, watching his daughter begin another round with one of her handmaids. She looked happy, but he could tell she wasn't. He hadn't missed her flirtatiously gazing at the earless convict. How baffling. Women's hearts. Who would want such a man? A woman who had everything, he supposed. Who was very bored. His mood blackened as he considered his failings as a father. He had not raised Allison.
He'd left that to nurses and servants. Her mother, a courtesan, had died a few days after Allison's birth. Marvel had not cared for the woman, really, beyond her pedigree as a daughter of a fine family of the Cape. A few pangs of guilt when she died. He'd prayed over it. Women died in childbirth. It was sad. He had needed a child. He had gotten a child. Glorify. At times, Marvel felt as though he didn't care what happened to anyone. And just as often, he felt the weight of his guilt like armor, impeding his every attempt to free himself. Why had he not left last night, after speaking with Michael? Allison looked at him from across the golf course. A few drops of rain fell from the bright gray sky. The sunlight had been swallowed by the clouds, and now the comets, the Stella Novae, whatever they were hidden. Allison's round face broke into a tentative smile as she motioned for them to join them again, waving her club in the air. Marvel shook his head darkly. He sighed. This was what he truly needed a pardon for. Abandoning his daughter. Tygo coughed at his side. Are we going somewhere? Or should we begin another game with them? Marvel chuckled. I'm sure you'd like that. She is a beautiful woman. Lonely, said Marvel suddenly. Aren't we all? He glanced down at Tygo. This close, he could see the ear holes, the scarring around them like puckered, waterlogged skin. Very profound. In Kansas, you were a priest, I take it. Who said anything about Kansas? Do you know who I am? Marvel asked suddenly. Marvel Parsons. Was Tygo sent to bring word to the Mystagogue that Marvel was high priest of the opposing sect? To learn whatever secrets the Cape knew of the cosmos that Kansas did not? Was this why he'd ingratiated himself to John Sousa? Or had he come simply to kill Marvel and be done with it? No. Do you know who I am? Really? Born to be the true king. A failure. Tygo's hands, still shackled, did not shake. He took a long breath, as though he were tired of talking about it. That's not why I'm here. Ah, Marvel leaned back. So he did know, or was pretending to for some reason. Tell me then. You know I can have you tortured. Why are you here? He paused. Why are you here? Tygo tugged his hair down over his ear holes. When at last he spoke, his voice was soft, almost helpless. A droplet of rain landed on his eyebrows, and he brushed it away. Because I'm a visionary. What did you see? The truth, Tygo said. We all receive portions of truth, I think. He faced Marvel head on and said, I saw the end of this world. Marvel began to laugh. Oh, only that. They went to Canaveral Tower, where Juniper was waiting for them. He had run ahead to warn the Pardoness of their arrival. He was a good servant, Marvel decided, after all. He would like to keep him. The pardon was all he needed, or rather, wanted. Then he would leave. The Pardoness received Marvel this time in a loose golden robe. She sat in her bed again, her gigantic legs lost somewhere in the folds of blankets. Her hair and face were uncovered now, her cheekbones pressed against her skin. All that she consumed feeding those enormous legs, and nothing else. The ledges of her clavicles made Marvel want to touch his own to make sure they had not broken through his skin. There were no servants attending her at this hour. To her right was a very tall bookshelf containing old books, so many that some were stuck into the shelves 2 or 3 layers deep, overflowing even to her bedside, where there was yet another stack. A small collapsible wooden table sat at her elbow. She was bent over it, writing. She glanced up as Marvel entered, placing the pen in its inkpot. She said, Puzzles. There is a man in the palace who makes them for me. That is his entire purpose. She pointed to Tygo and Juniper, who had been waiting by the doorway. Well, here we all are. At last.
She nodded skeptically at Tygo.
He is quite small, now that I see him. How will he manage to remove my legs?
What? Tygo paled.
My legs? How will you remove them?
His mouth seemed to have gone dry.
I'm sorry. I don't understand.
Marvel took Tygo by his chained arms and dragged him into the center of the chamber.
Surgeon, whose patients live almost always, take off her diseased legs.
Tygo cursed under his breath. He swept back his black hair, and it stayed just where he left it, in a swirl above his right ear hole.
You can do it, can't you?
Asked the Pardoness.
I can see by your face that you think you can't.
Tygo flushed. There was none of the medicinal smoke filling the chamber this time, but the smell was still peculiar, like no one had aired out the room in the longest time. Marvel noticed there was only one large airway, a closed door that led to the balcony.
What's wrong with your legs?
Tygo croaked at last. She pushed the folds of fabric away and heaved the appendages toward the front of the bed, each leg 100 pounds.
More.
When Tygo saw them, he gave no reaction. Juniper crept forward to get a better view. Marvel yanked him back again.
My name is Green Butterfly, she said to Tygo. If you did not know already.
Marvel took pleasure in her voice, which was unusual and beautiful, even though he realized now that she had some speech impediment, or had never learned to speak correctly in the first place.
The thought made him sad. I wish to be like my namesake, and fly away. Please remove my legs if you can, so I can leave this place.
Tygo began to shake his head.
No, these are... What disease is this?
You're the doctor. You tell us, Marvel barked. But darkness had begun forming again inside him at Tygo's obvious confusion. Of course he was no surgeon.
What a fool Marvel had been to even think it, that a walking doctor had come from Kansas to the Cape?
Who had even ever heard of such a thing?
Walking doctors take an oath to do no harm, Tygo muttered. Primum non nocere. If I took it upon myself to operate, I couldn't be sure you wouldn't die.
Escape is my aim, she said,
leaning forward and meeting his eyes. Her own were dark brown, almost black.
Whatever the means at this point.
Marvel rested his eyes on Tygo.
If you are not a surgeon, what are you?
The Pardoness joined him in staring at Tygo, her eyes disappearing into her face, dark circles acute with comprehension.
Then have you come to confess,
if you are not a doctor?
I did some healing in Kansas, some simple things I learned from my mother, and the rest I...
He seemed to slump.
I was just getting by. I never thought I'd get picked up for it, much less asked to use it on someone so...
He swallowed.
Important.
In a flash of impotent rage, Marvel shoved Tygo to the ground. He spilled onto the floor and slid for a few feet, unable to stop himself with his chained arms.
Who took your ears? Was it the Mystagogue?
Marvel shouted.
How did you get here from Kansas? Why did you come? Who sent you?
Juniper instantly was at Tygo's side, pulling him to his feet. Marvel turned on him as well, his suspicions erupting from him, suddenly awestruck by his own complacency.
And you, he yelled to the guard. You are a spy. I've known it since the beginning. You're not from a carnival. You're from Kansas, too. You were sent to flatter and trick me.
He shoved Juniper away. Marvel wished he carried a dagger instead of poison.
I'll have you thrown in the jail if you don't confess.
Juniper stumbled backward, the small sack on his belt containing his head bouncing against his thigh. The Pardoness only sat in her nest of golden silk, unsmiling, unruffled.
Yes, confess. Perhaps everyone should confess.
Marvel whirled toward her, about to scream at her too, until he felt the Pardoness's eyes. Gentle, calm. In the round, stuffy room, he became at once aware of his own petulance, his own pointless personal agony. Green Butterfly watched them all. Then, at last, she smiled. She cleared her throat.
My, my. What excitement.
She kneaded her knobby fingers together, like she was knitting a garment in her lap.
All because of my poor legs.
Pardoness. Forgive me,
Marvel said, smoothing his graying hair and arranging his cassock's belt. He bowed shallowly.
I lost my head.
You are forgiven.
She pointed at Tygo and Juniper and spoke in a quiet voice.
I see I am not to be freed by anyone here. But perhaps you men might be. Shall you two receive pardons as well?
They both stood motionless. She beckoned to Marvel. Against his better judgment, he went to her. She reached for his hand and cradled it in her own.
What do you want, Marvel Parsons?
Forgiveness.
For what?
For leaving when there is a threat at our gates. For wanting to go home. For my nostalgia. For
everything.
My daughter will never be able to follow me if I leave. The king will never know why I've gone. The outlaw carnival. For using those two.
He gestured at Juniper and Tygo.
For my own aims.
Then he took a heavy breath.
For all the murders.
She considered.
You were going to kill the Mystagogue.
Yes. Do you know of him? Is he alive?
He lives. Yes.
He would never let me live if I returned to Kansas.
No, he wouldn't.
He paused, defenseless.
Is it right to kill him? It's the only way I can be free.
All I want is to be free.
She lifted her bony shoulders into a shrug.
We all want the same thing.
She laughed. It was a light laugh. A girl running among flowers.
I cannot make you free if you are bound to do evil.
But I'm not, he whispered. What I'm doing is right. I'm almost sure of it.
How do you know they are not right also?
He slumped a bit.
I don't know what to do.
She held his hand ever so softly.
Marvel,
the truth comes unbidden to us, completely without warning.
Go to Kansas. Don't go to Kansas. The truth will find you eventually.
She nodded.
You are forgiven for your past sins. You may forgive yourself for your future ones.
Marvel remembered suddenly a bright day from his boyhood. The summer sky like a wild, flashing fish, his hands in his itchy cloak pockets as he climbed to the top of a butte and looked with pleasure at all he could see.
This land, so beautiful,
poisoned ground and all. He stood with his bare feet on the dirt, gazing over the grasses and the fields, and in the distance, reaching skyward, was the black watchtower. Its crenellated spire, its monkish austerity, where his own mother, Nassa Whiteside, had been thrown to her death for finally failing to conceive the true king. He'd struggled, even then, to understand the beauty and horribleness of their condition, how amid all splendor they had come to be wretched. Warm breezes had swept the plain, turning the rose-colored grasses this way and that, and Marvel was so moved that he could hardly stand the feeling, and climbed down again.
Wandering away from their settlement alone had been a stupid thing to do, and when he'd returned, his nursemaid demanded to know which safe road he had taken to climb the hill. When he told her he didn't know, she fell to crying, certain that he'd contracted Benthead. But somehow, Marvel had known that he had not. Just as, a few years later, he had known he would not die when he crossed the continent on his journey to the Cape. He had known then, just as he knew now. But this time, he had needed to be told. He would meet the leaders of the Outlaw Carnival. He would advise Michael. Then he would leave. The Pardoness smiled. Tygo's face was still red from his fall, but suddenly he came toward the Pardoness with an eager look on his face.
"Tell Lochvovin,"
Tygo said. "What?" she asked.
"The angels told me that."
Marvel pushed him away. For a moment, all he could think of was holding the Pardoness's hand as long as possible, the papery skin so soft it could have been silk. He longed for her to smile at him again, but she said, "Let him speak."
"To Lochvovin. It means falling death."
Tygo stared pointedly at the door to the balcony, then at the Pardoness once again.
"I'm sorry. I did lie about my abilities. It's what I've always done, to get by. I had no idea it would lead me to Kansas, and certainly not back here. Or to you now. I meant only..."
He glared at Marvel. The ear holes gaped, then his face showed only fatigue.
"I only wanted to do the right thing. I came here for a man named David. I don't know where he is. I've been trying to keep myself alive until I find him."
He chuckled.
"It hasn't been easy."
"But who sent you?"
Marvel asked. Tygo blinked.
"You've known since you first saw me."
Marvel sighed. Juniper was looking at the balcony door. The Pardoness sighed too.
"Well, who sent you?" Marvel asked Juniper.
He shrugged.
"The Mystagogue. I came to make sure Tygo didn't get put in jail. Which he did. But I don't know why the Mystagogue sent me. That's the honest truth."
He frowned at Marvel. "There had been rumors about you. That you were alive here. But the Mystagogue didn't believe them."
"Rumors,"
Marvel muttered. He felt a stinging, a sensation confusing and inexorable. The Pardoness smiled at all of them. Her golden robe shimmered. She settled herself back in her bed, as if to indicate the meeting had ended. Drained of all his energy, Marvel stabbed his fingernail into his callus again.
"They call the Mystagogue's tower in Kansas the Watchtower of the Universe. But maybe you see farther even than that, Pardoness."
He bowed. She shrugged.
"I see what you show me."
Tygo came toward the Pardoness again, passing Marvel without a glance. He took her hand, which was as skeletal as a bird picked clean on a doorstep. Her expression was one Marvel could only guess at. The look was the kind one could see once and never forget, though in the past he'd often considered such sentiments to be maudlin. Within that exchange was contained the arc of lifetimes. Love, hope, disappointment, acceptance. The Pardoness had looked at him with that expression moments before, and he had known the experience would never leave him. Now she looked at Tygo the same way, and Marvel understood forgiveness existed beyond a person's capacity to accept it. Tygo stared into her eyes.
"The word from the angels. Tell Lochvovin," he said. "Maybe they meant it for you."
She smiled again. She was gazing now at the balcony door.
"What a strange turn of fortune to learn this word. You are all marvelous indeed."
Chapter 21. The Pardon. Mr. Capellatio blew back through the curtains in late afternoon, a murky look on his face. His hat was gone. His hair was undone. Sad-looking. Blood on his forearms. She had been trying to sleep, but none had come for her. The crones had taken Orchid away. The girl could not decide if she wished the other woman would die of her injuries.
"Don't stare at me like that," he barked. "It's a nice early winter day. Let's be happy."
But he did not look happy. She wanted to go closer to him, but found she couldn't budge from where she sat on the bed, among his blankets and furs.
"You should be in your cage," he growled. "Where it's safe."
She said nothing.
"We'll have our day today. We are going to the palace to talk to the fools in charge. They have agreed to see us. It is truly hopeless for them to resist, and they won't, not after the magic I'm doing."
He began to take off his clothes, stripping out of his still wet shirt and dark red pants. He stood naked, his members slightly swollen despite the chill in the air, and she couldn't keep from looking. It was not as large as Argento's, but more nicely formed. It bobbed when he walked.
"There isn't much time now," he was saying. He began rummaging in one of his boxes,
the shadows formed by the indented sides of his buttocks as dark as eyes. His mobiles of sacred glass tinkled as he knocked against them while he gathered more things. She found him beautiful. When had it changed that she couldn't stop looking at him? She wanted desperately for him to come over to her, for him to wrap his arms around her. He had a way of kissing her that drove a burning spike into her heart. But he wouldn't look at her.
"You have humiliated me and maimed my wife," he said after a long time.
"I thought you wanted me to kill her."
"The Star Sapphire ritual is not about death. It's about life.
You told me to cut off her head."
He shook his head. "You are an idiot. A new law of mercy? You are weak. A coward. Orchid would never have hesitated to cut your head off."
He turned on his heel and bent close to her face.
"But it's no matter. We've put into motion our petrifying destiny. We've begun the spell which will grant us our kingship. We are ready, even if we are not ready, to take the cape."
Then he was at his wash basin, wiping down his arms and hands, removing the visible bloodstains, then his underarms, which he perfumed with a citrus-smelling talc he kept in a lidded dish on his desk.
"But I do think Wonder Blood has ended," she said, standing. "It must have."
"What do you know? Have you even read the book?"
"A little."
"Then tell me, girl, since you're an expert now, since you're qualified to interpret the texts you didn't even know existed until lately, why did you cut off my wife's hand? My radiance. My glassine prism. My scribe. Why did you take from her that which she needs for writing?"
"I don't understand." Her voice was cold. "Why it matters, if you wanted me to kill her. Why don't you just kill her if you want her dead?"
"Because that's not how the spell works," he yelled.
She shrank back and sat again on the bed. He followed her and spoke in her face, his breath hot.
"When I killed our prophetess Lois, Orchid's own mother, I was little more than a child myself, though she called me a man. She gave her life to me so I might have this chance. She gave me her daughter, the heir of Hulda, so that our children might be legitimate heirs. My child with the aged Lois died in his sleep, not 7 weeks old."
His voice softened, becoming almost sad. "But Orchid cannot have children."
"So I was supposed to kill her?"
"To legitimate our line."
"Her death would have been a sacrifice, an unparalleled gift to the heavens.
Who knows where you are from? You came from a field. Who will your children be?
We have no way of knowing.
You've said yourself that one of our sons may kill me."
I was just saying what I thought you wanted to hear."
He weakly closed his eyes.
"Please don't tell me that. I cannot bear it."
Then, still naked, he strode past her, toweling moisture away with a cloth. He opened another box and pulled out a new set of clothing. Mr. Capellatio stepped into the pants,
these ones made of pale leather and stitched with gold thread, and pulled them halfway up. His thighs were covered in sparse black hair, the muscles standing out like cords. He tucked his member into them and adjusted it to his liking.
I made these. Do you like them? When I was a boy myself, I sewed for our prophetess. She liberated me from that soulless carnival I was born into. I sewed there, too. Bags for the heads. Wretched heads they made in that carnival, even worse than your brother's. Ugly and terribly magicked. Barely worth the effort. He glanced up. My other wife recorded all the events of my life for posterity. You should read it sometime. He went to the corner where the dripping sack containing Orchid's severed hand was still oozing, picked it up, and placed it into another bag, this one made of a tough horsehide that wouldn't leak. She hardened her voice. It's better not to think about the past. Mr. Capellatio, when agitated, had a cold mania that seeped into his voice, that same bland restlessness that had so terrified the girl in the first moment she saw him on the battlefield, standing beside the striped tent, like he owned the world. She tried to remember how he'd seemed in those first moments before she knew him, before she had begun to love him. Composed and unhinged all the same. How that combination had stopped the blood in her heart. Mr. Capellatio was now donning an eye-blue vest. He slipped his arms through the holes and dusted himself down, although he was impeccably clean. In the mirror, he frowned. You can make it up to me. How do you think I might die? Sugar Plum. My queen? Try again. Isn't it likely I might die inside that massive castle, outnumbered 1,000 to 1?
Maybe. I don't know.
He sat beside her in the tumble of blankets, stroking her hair. Tell me about the law of mercy. There will always be dissent, and dissidents are exempt from the law of mercy, I'm sure. For instance, what if a queen disobeys her king? There must be a codification of this new law, some way to understand its nuances, since surely it will be revealed to have many. Tell me, who will do that?
I will.
You? You are a fetus, a child.
You said I was the queen.
You're beginning to act like a queen. I'll say that. He unbuckled his pants.
No,
she said, her breath speeding up. She did not think he would. He had never struck her. He had never even touched her when she did not touch back. The thin leather bunched as he pushed his pants down, and out sprang his member, already hard. He pushed her back onto her elbows, her skull striking the headboard. It didn't hurt, but the surprise brought tears to her eyes. He pulled her dress up with the other hand, his fingers lingering for a moment on the bandaged spot. It's good we got rid of it, he hissed. It would have been a bad omen indeed. It would have cast all this into doubt. But there is no remnant of your past unfaithfulness now. He swept aside the thin white skirt. Something in his face. It was like she wasn't there. He had gone from familiar to ghastly in half a moment. It must be the magic he had done, she told herself. He couldn't be like this. She tried to scramble away.
Don't, she said. Please.
There is another bit of magic we can do. Don't you want me to succeed?
Stop.
He held her neck to the bed, his other arm supporting his weight, the veins standing out from exertion.
You said sex magic was bad, that it was for degenerates.
I was just saying what I thought you wanted to hear, he replied in a sing-song voice. He rubbed himself against her leg.
You said you wouldn't hurt me.
He was nodding. Yes. And then I said, except on the inside.
You'll be breaking the law of mercy,
she whispered, as she felt him begin to press into her. But then he stopped. She was not crying. He hovered over her, the slick knot of his hair undone now, and they both panted as they stared at each other through the revolving shadows cast by the hanging charms.
What would happen to someone who breaks the law? He sat back suddenly. Do you think they would die? She moved as far away from him as she could, pulling all the blankets over her lap.
I think anyone who hurts another person will regret it.
Well, I must kill their king after we take the compound. There can be no other way.
You'll know the right thing to do when the time comes to do it.
His face softened. Aurora, you are kind. You are the sigil of peace. A girl in white upon the battlefield. You are better than she is. He gestured at the bag with Orchid's hand. She who is always grabbing for power. Willing to do anything. But you stood your ground. You stand your ground. Against me. For me. He gently kissed her. If cutting off her hand was what the magic told you to do, it must be right. He pulled up his pants, then cupped his own face in his hands. What am I becoming? Who am I? Only degenerates work in sex magic. I did say that. He shook her a bit roughly. You must forgive me. It's this place. It's... I'm losing my mind, Aurora. I don't know up from down. Cautiously, she caressed his knee. Lead me to the truth. She kissed him. He kissed her back. Again, he took up the bag with the hand in it. He said, Right seems wrong, and wrong seems right. She nodded. He left, and she felt her heart, a feather, floating down from a precipice. She had thought he would save her, but now she understood she would have to save herself. Chapter 22 Faith Tell Lokvovin. It was the language of angels, so said Tygo. Falling death. Of course, he might have made the whole thing up. It was very possible. With the two Stella Novi hanging above their heads, an ominous quality could well be ascribed to the word. But John was not so sure Tygo had ever seen anything more remarkable than the weaknesses of others. John's own, for instance. John Sousa did admit that he was in search of a miracle, and had been for a long time. A vision of the sublime that might, once and for all, convince him of its truth. Tygo need not have been a genius to see that John was a man who had always wanted to believe. If the Stella Novi were to Lokvovin, they would all soon be dead, and none of it would matter. John cast his eyes out the window of this great lower hall of the southeast tower, Columbia. There the lights burned, through the gray haze. He was seated at a long table with Tygo and King Michael and the Hierophant, flanked by four armed guards. They awaited the Outlaw Carnival's faction. Somewhat too jovially, John felt. The horoscope he'd drawn up had been predictably vague. He and Michael had taken their usual roles. John urged caution while Michael laughed and replied that John was far, far too cautious.
There are so many ways to read that, John. Why do you always choose the worst?
But there had been a worrisome aspect to the reading. Two opposing planets. One ascendant. One on the wane. In his view, the ascendant body did not represent Michael himself. But of course, Michael had not taken it that way. He had pointed to the offending planet and its aspect, his narrow finger jabbing the chart. Michael had nodded eagerly. The horoscope showed at least one thing clearly, that the true king would be present at the meeting today. John's thoughts had taken an odd turn. Does Michael even believe he should be king? Would he be happy to be overthrown? The whole affair had unsettled him. Now John and Tygo were seated a bit to the right of Michael and the Hierophant, lower than the dais that elevated the more important men behind the table. Michael had changed out of his plain clothing into a robe of cosmic black, sewn with moonstones. John had also affixed a dress collar onto his own astronomer's caftan. Moonstones. Again, patterned like the constellation of Orion, repeating around the length of it. The collar was a very old Sousa family heirloom, with the hereditary peacock insignia engraved in miniature upon the surface of each gem.
Lately, the collar had become too loose, and John felt it drooped unflatteringly. Mizar had been wise enough to pack the collar in the carriage in the first place. How did he always know what to bring? And yet he did. Some servant's wizardry, as well as an extra set of clothing for Tygo, who had finally been unchained. He wore a plain dark velvet robe, probably the finest garment he'd ever worn. The Hierophant still wore his plain caftan. He energetically glared at the large metal door, as if willing the other party to appear, his fingers absently tugging one of the hems on his sleeve. John wished the other group would never arrive. His own palms were dampening. He wiped them on his chair cushion. Michael spoke in a low tone to Marvel.
They stated only that they had a proposition concerning the Stella Novi. I'm more than certain they're here to request revisions in the law, now that the shuttles are returning. As rightly they should. I'm willing to make changes to the law when the world itself changes. I'm not my father. I will show them that.
The Hierophant narrowed his eyes.
That this is the return is quite an assumption. And how did these outlaws know when they would appear? How did they arrive at the perfect time? We had no idea ourselves.
No warning. He shot a pointed look at John.
By the looks of their crowd, they intend to assemble here for quite some time. Our scouts say they are armed.
Of course they're armed. They're carnivals.
And they continued this way. John, stinging from Marvel's passive denigration, could tell Tygo was listening as well, but felt himself pulled out of the conversation again and again by some formless anxiety, a threat of a special doom that had fallen just now upon him like a band of shadow. He was, he supposed, given to hysterics, but this was different, not just a minor churning of the gut. John stared at the great ceremonial door at the bottom of Columbia Tower. He felt guided quite firmly toward the inescapable conclusion that something was about to go very wrong. The group of five carnival men were escorted in by the lion-masked guards. Two guards took their places by the door, crossing their pikes to bar any exit. To John's surprise, the retinue included a woman. She was nearly 30 years of age. Her dress had sleeves that covered her hands. Her face was incredibly difficult to look at, but whether this was because she was very beautiful or very ugly, he could not tell. The eyebrows were pale and heavy, the mouth childlike, the eyes ravaging, painful to behold, like wounds in her head. Her hair had been fixed into a high hair form, which was the style in the carnivals. The women at the Cape had long since given it up. The entire cadre was an unpleasantly rough-looking sort, even though they were no doubt combed and powdered to present their best faces. There was no hiding the dirt of their world. John saw it in the corners of their eyes, under their fingernails, even from this far away. What lives they must lead, out there on the continent. He realized he'd never thought about people beyond the Cape, except when the carnivals returned once a year to make their offerings to the crown. Even then he was hard-pressed to leave the comforts of his own offices unless it was absolutely necessary. Carnival people seemed simple. Cut off some heads, spill some blood, hope for a miracle that never occurred. Where was the exactitude, the tedious devotion? John had not the boisterousness for their kind of faith, nor the bloodlust. Each of the ruffians exhibited different colors on their persons. Surely they represented different carnivals. Try as he might, John could not recall the names of even the more famous carnivals in history, even though he'd learned a rhyme as a schoolboy that listed them all. They all sat down opposite them at the long table. This close, they seemed no less foreign, faces uniformly hardened, sun-speckled from the past summer's adventures. Two of them were darker, obviously brothers. One was a stocky pale beard, the other tall and dark-skinned. The last was the youngest, who wore his oiled hair in a center part and plaited down his back in some ghastly outlaw style. He sat upon the cushioned chair with a dreamy aplomb, taking in the great hall and all the beautiful wall hangings and carpets, and seemed singularly delighted by all of it. His face was the face of an innocent dreaming. The Hierophant had several folders ready, large vellum